Good evening. I am delighted to be here as part of this conversation, if you will, about gun violence. And my role is to put it in context. Let me just escape out of here. Open the slides. To escape twice. Should be open. Okay. And what I want to do is talk about achieving health equity and putting gun violence in context. First of all, talking about, well, we know, like, we were having a conversation at lunch today, and it's like, why should any of us consider gun violence a public health emergency or a public health issue at all? And it's because even as we, as physicians, might deal with the impacts of gun violence on our patients or on our families or in the emergency departments where we work, we need to also ask a why question. We can't be content with just seeing one after another person or hearing on the news one after another community severely impacted by gun violence without asking the question that extends not just with the individual but with the context in which we find ourselves. As a family physician, general preventive medicine physician, and also a PhD in epidemiology, I am now have a very strong public health perspective. And that public health perspective means that the why question has to look at context, community context, societal context. Public health for decades now has identified violence, all violence, as a public health issue, starting with Dr. Deborah Prothro-Stith, who is the commissioner of public health in Massachusetts, and her experience as an ER doc had told her that, you know, she wanted to stop patching people up who came in on Saturday night but tried to prevent those gun injuries. And from then on, we have been building this evidence that by paying attention to broader issues, we should have some impact on making headway, but we have had resistance in this country. I'm not going to talk about the resistance, but what I am going to start with is a framework that's going to help all of us understand relationships between different levels of health intervention. I call this my cliff analogy, and so let's go. Here we have somebody walking along the cliff. Whoops! Boom! Somebody just fell off of the cliff of good health. And if that were you or someone in your family, you would be delighted to find an ambulance at the bottom of the cliff to speed you onto care. But if we were concerned about others who might come along that cliff face, if we were concerned about public health or population health or community health, we might well ask ourselves, what could we put in place as a health intervention besides just stationing lots of ambulances at the bottom of the cliff? So somebody in the room is gonna say, I know, let's put a net halfway down. That way, even if people fall, we can catch them before they get crunched up at the bottom. And that certainly is an excellent idea, although nets do have holes in them, so some people might fall through the cracks. But we could even make that a trampoline halfway down that cliff. No holes in a trampoline. But even if we had a trampoline halfway down that cliff, we might find ourselves with lots of people just bouncing up and down at half functionality, not able to get back to the top of the cliff. So you might ask, what else could we put in place as a health intervention? Well, clearly we need to be thinking about a fence at the edge of the cliff to keep people from falling in the first place. But even that fence is going to have to be a very, very strong fence if there's a lot of population pressure against it. So what else can we do as a health intervention? We can move the population away from the edge of the cliff. So I'm going to describe the interventions that I've depicted on this cliff animation so far, where the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff represents medical care, as well as tertiary prevention. So on the public health side of the house, we talk about three levels of prevention: primary, secondary, tertiary. Tertiary prevention is preventing complications from disease that's already manifest. So it could be preventing amputations from diabetes and the like. That net or trampoline halfway down, these are our safety net programs, often in our social services, as well as secondary prevention, which is all about early detection, screening. The fence at the edge of the cliff represents primary prevention, keeping bad things from happening in the first place. And we'll talk about some policy interventions that could act there, but even things like immunization, would represent a fence. And addressing the social determinants of health, that's how we describe moving the population away from the edge of the cliff. Now, I don't know how many in the room are familiar with that concept or the phraseology of addressing the social determinants of health. So about half of this audience and perhaps half of our listening audience. So let me talk about that a little bit more. These social determinants of health are the determinants of health and illness that are outside of the individual. They're beyond our individual genes, and they're beyond our individual behaviors, including risk behaviors or health protective behaviors. They are, in fact, the context of our lives, the context in which our behaviors even have meaning and confer risk or protection. So they include, for example, individual contexts like income or education. So poverty is a huge social determinant of health. They include neighborhood context, like the availability of guns in your neighborhood or the availability of fruits and vegetables in your neighborhood. Can you even get fruits and vegetables in your neighborhood if you're trying to eat 5 to 9 servings of fruits and vegetables a day, right? Or do you live in what some describe as a food desert or others describe as a fast food swamp? Are there jobs in your neighborhood, or are the only jobs in the informal economy where you're more at risk of being shot, right? Is there even transportation if there aren't jobs to your neighborhood? Is it safe to walk in your neighborhood if you want to get 30 minutes of exercise 5 days a week? Or are you at risk of random gun violence, targeted gun violence, or even police-inflicted gun violence? And so on and so forth. So when we talk about this cliff, in terms of gun violence, the ambulance would represent our emergency departments and care. The net or trampoline halfway down the cliff, that might be programs that people are putting in communities at risk to talk about problem solving, you know, de-escalation and that kind of thing. The fence would certainly be policy interventions as well as perhaps programs to gun exchange, taking guns out of the community and the like, just decreasing the availability. And addressing the social determinants of health is having a living wage so that people don't have to go, and having the availability of jobs, having excellent schools so that young people don't drop out of school and have no other recourse and the like. Now, we could use this diagram, we could use it in terms of infant mortality. We could say the ambulance was neonatal intensive care units, the net or trampoline would be our prenatal care. The fence might be our women, infants, and children programs for excellent maternal nutrition. And again, moving the population away from the edge of the cliff might be excellent educational opportunities so young girls didn't have babies so early. This diagram actually lends itself to a lot of different outcomes, and it lends itself to community conversations and conversations with policymakers about how should we be spending our resources. But as useful as this diagram is, there is a huge fatal flaw in it, because so far this diagram does not equip us to have a conversation about how health disparities arise. So I want you to keep this cliff in the back of your mind, but we're going to shift gears for just a moment to talk about how health disparities arise, and then we'll come back to the cliff. So how do health disparities arise? Well, especially when you're talking about racial ethnic health disparities, we unfortunately have lots of evidence about differences in the quality of care received within the healthcare system. You may remember that in 2002, the Institute of Medicine released its Unequal Treatment Report, which pulled together what were then hundreds of studies. If we were to do the same thing today, it would be thousands of studies, but hundreds of studies documenting differences, even for patients who are seen within the same healthcare system, everybody in the VA system or your hospital system or your county or everybody covered by Medicare or Medicaid, differences by race, for example, in how vigorously your chest pain might be investigated or treated, or differences by ethnicity in terms of how much pain medication you might get if you presented at an emergency department with a long bone fracture. And that was astounding news to the medical profession at that time, because we all tried to do our best, but there were very well documented differences by race and ethnicity in the quality of care. But even that Institute of Medicine recognized that that was not the full explanation for differences, for racial ethnic differences in health outcomes, because they acknowledged that some people can't even get into the healthcare system in the first place. So the second level at which health disparities arise are in terms of access to care. But then I'm hoping that all of us in this room and in the listening audience recognize that health is not created within the health sector. And so, in fact, a third level at which health disparities arise are actually the differences in the conditions of our lives, and differences in our life opportunities, exposures, and stresses, which are making some individuals and communities sicker than others in the first place. And if you were to think about these three levels at which health disparities arise, differences in quality of care, differences in access to care, and differences in underlying exposures and opportunities, you could depict it as a pyramid, for example, or better yet, you could understand it as an iceberg where the huge hidden base are the differences in the conditions of our lives. And then very often the same people who have been made sicker are the same ones who are frustrated because of limited access to the healthcare system, and then even the lucky ones who get into the system are sometimes further injured because of differences in quality of care. So now, remembering those three levels at which health disparities arise, we're going to go back to our cliff. But now we're going to recognize that we're really not dealing with a flat, two-dimensional cliff, but actually we're dealing with a three-dimensional cliff. And at some parts of the cliff, there might be an ambulance there, but maybe that ambulance has a flat tire. So it's slow or goes off in the wrong direction. Or maybe there's no ambulance there at all, and maybe there's no net nor fence. And usually, at those parts of the cliff, the population is being pushed closer to the edge. So now I'd like to label these observations about our three-dimensional cliff with how health disparities arise, where the differences in quality of care, that's represented when an ambulance is there, but it's slow or goes off in the wrong direction. Differences in access to care are no ambulance, no net, no fence. And differences in underlying exposures and opportunities are represented by the closer proximity of that greeny population to the edge. So now that we recognize that we're dealing with a three-dimensional cliff, there's a whole new set of questions that arise. The first of all, of course, is how did the cliff become three-dimensional in the first place? And that's usually because of historical injustices that are perpetuated by present-day contemporary structural factors. But given that we're dealing with a three-dimensional cliff, we also need to ask, why are there differences in how resources are distributed along that cliff face? And why are there differences in who's found at different parts of the cliff? Why are the orangies back here in a way and the greenies being pushed closer to the edge? And when you start asking and addressing those kinds of questions, you are now doing something that differs from addressing the social determinants of health, which we described as moving the population away from the edge of the cliff. You are now doing something that I describe as addressing the social determinants of equity, which are systems of power that can distribute resources and populations, where these social determinants of equity or inequity include racism, sexism, heterosexism, economic systems like capitalism, and the like. And so actually, with this cliff, I have distilled three different dimensions of health intervention. And if you go back to your junior high or high school geometry, where one dimension is a line, two dimensions is a flat plane, and three dimensions is space, well, it's along the line at the edge of the cliff where we can display all of our health services. Our curative and preventive health services are right there in that ambulance, net, and fence at the edge of the cliff. And that's where most of us operate. In fact, if you ask most people in this country, if you say the word health, they will complete that thought for you and go immediately to health care or health services. This is where our conversation about the Affordable Care Act has been. And I would hope that we would go beyond the Affordable Care Act to eventually get universal access to high-quality health care like every other high-income country in the world. But the reason that we would be moving toward universal access to high quality healthcare is not because that, in and of itself, would result in large and sustained improvements in health outcomes or the elimination of health disparities. We need universal access to high quality healthcare because that is how a civilized society values all of its people equally. But even if we had the most wonderful system with the most universal access, you can overwhelm any system if everybody's crowded up against it. So we must move into that second dimension, which we can display in a flat plane. We must be about moving the population away from the edge of the cliff by addressing the social determinants of health, including poverty, adverse neighborhood conditions, and the like, if we want to have large and sustained improvements in health outcomes. But the trick there is that if we are about addressing the social determinants of health without recognizing that we're dealing with a three-dimensional cliff, We are at risk of moving some of the population away from the edge of the cliff, but not all of the population, and actually making health disparities worse. So we must acknowledge and address the three-dimensionality of the cliff by addressing these social determinants of equity or inequity, including racism, sexism, heterosexism, capitalism, and the like, these systems of power that can distribute resources and populations if we want to achieve social justice and eliminate health disparities. Now, as I said, this three-dimensional cliff has many, many uses. Today, I wasn't able to complete this exercise by this evening, but I started looking at some of the recommendations that at least the American Academy of Pediatrics has put out there in terms of gun violence and saying, well, where do they array on this three-dimensional cliff? Right? Are they at the ambulance level, the net, the fence, the moving the population away from the edge of the cliff, or addressing the three-dimensionality of the cliff? So I didn't even look at the resolution from AMA yet and those specific recommendations. And I'm sure that many of you, and I'm sure that Dr. Archer will help fill in some of these blanks. But with regard to the American Academy of Pediatrics, they were quite clear that they felt in the three or four different guiding documents that, I don't know what that means. How many minutes? What is the green?
5 minutes.
5 minutes? Okay, well, so we'll see. That the best way to keep our children safe is from injury or death from guns is to never have guns in the home. So they were basically at that fence, and their specific recommendations included: do not purchase a gun, especially a handgun, remove all guns present in the home, find out if there are guns in the homes where your children play. These are recommendations that they're making to parents of young children. If so, talk to the adults in the house about the dangers of guns to their families. So as pediatricians, they are saying, first of all, they're in the ambulance, they're at the medical care level, but their recommendations for parents are at the fence level. They also said, for those who know the danger of guns but still keep a gun in the home, these are some recommendations. Always keep the gun unloaded and locked up. Lock and store the bullets in a separate place. Make sure to hide the keys to the locked boxes. Equip guns with trigger locks. And there are many, many other recommendations. People are talking about thumbprinting so that only an authorized user can do a pressure thing so that young children can't use it. But these are net types of things if you already have a gun in the home. And they also said to let children know about the risk of gun injuries that may exist in the places where they play, in the homes of their playmates. They did have some recommendations that were at the moving the population away from the edge of the fence level in terms of context. So they actually had strong recommendations about implementing gun control legislation, including banning assault weapons and high-capacity ammunition magazines, regulating handguns and handgun ammunition, restricting handgun ownership, and reducing the number of privately owned handguns. They did not have any specific recommendations at the level of addressing the three-dimensionality of the cliff, and perhaps what we really need are even other sectors to come in and make recommendations like that. We need law enforcement to be doing some of that. We need education systems and the like. And this is where we now have to acknowledge that medicine and even the health sector are limited in our impact. We need to bridge to other sectors for these very important issues that find the final indicators in the health and well-being of the nation. Right? Health is an indicator, if you will. It is not the central good, I would say, that most of us have focused our life work on, but they are actually indicators of what's happening in the society, and when we recognize that, we have to move with other sectors. So I just wanted to very briefly define racism, because I've identified it as one of those social determinants of equity. After Dr. Archer speaks, then we'll have questions right now, but then Dr. Archer will speak and have questions, and then I'm going to come back and I'm going to share with you an allegory, my Gardner's Tale allegory, which will describe how racism can enter the body and turn into health outcomes like asthma, increases in asthma prevalence, obesity, and the like. But for right now, I'll define racism and just briefly illustrate it with a very short story. So when I say the word racism, I am clear that I am talking about a system. I'm not talking about an individual character flaw. I'm not talking about a personal moral failing. I'm not even talking about a psychiatric illness, as some people have suggested. But I'm talking about a system of power, and it's a system of doing what? It's a system of structuring opportunity and of assigning value. And on what basis is the opportunity structured, and on what basis is the value assigned? It's based on so-called race, based on the social interpretation of how one looks in this race-conscious society. I'll just briefly say, for those of you who are looking at me and those who are not, I am a light-skinned black woman. Here in Orlando, Florida, you look at me, I'm clearly black. But in some parts of Brazil, you would look at me and I'd be just as clearly white. And if you looked at me in South Africa, I'd be just as clearly colored. So here I am, same physical appearance, but the social interpretation of my appearance in just those three settings would assign me to three different racial groups. And furthermore, if I were to stay in any of those settings long enough, then my health outcome would probably take on that of the group to which I've been assigned, even though I'd have the same genes in all three places. So I've defined race as this social interpretation of how one looks, and racism as the system that acts on that, the system of structuring opportunity and assigning value based on that. What are the impacts of racism? Well, when we think about racism at all, we understand that it unfairly disadvantages some individuals and communities. But it doesn't take long to recognize that every unfair disadvantage has its reciprocal unfair advantage, so that racism is also unfairly advantaging other individuals and communities. And that's the whole issue of unearned white privilege that we hardly ever talk about. It's quite difficult, and I know that some of you may have just squirmed right now hearing me say those words. I want you to come back with me, because I'm going to tell you a story, if I can go a few minutes into my question time, to help us even understand that unearned white privilege. But even as we acknowledge, okay, we have a system that's either unfairly disadvantaging or unfairly advantaging individuals and communities, racism is sapping the strength of our whole society through the waste of human resources. I won't give you a lot of examples with that, just two very quickly. First is how we as a nation are not yet vigorously investing in the full, excellent public education of all of our children, because the blinders of racism have made some of us believe that there is no genius in the barrios or the ghettos or on the reservations. You know, we can get along very well, thank you, without those kids. But of course, there is genius in all of our communities. And if we were to only fully invest in that genius, we could be doing so much better as a nation, or even as a world. We might already be up on Mars farming, and we wouldn't even have to go to Mars to farm. We could be solving the problems in our communities today if we were to invest in all of that genius. Similarly, those same blinders have made us as a nation complacent with what I describe as the wholesale warehousing disproportionately of so many black and brown men in our prison system. And this is tied right up in the gun violence and the violence and community violence and all of that. And if you know any folks who are either stuck in the prisons or cycling in and out, because when you come out with a felony conviction, can't get a job often, can't get public housing, can't vote in many states. If you know any of these people, you know there are many geniuses. I was having a conversation earlier today that sometimes it's the best looking, smartest ones who are the gang leaders who get knocked off first, right? Many geniuses caught up in the system that if there were only some other way, they could be contributing quite productively to our society. So I actually think that of the three points that I've made about the impacts of racism, the unfair disadvantage, its reciprocal unfair advantage, and how it saps the strength of the whole society, we need more attention to that third point, because we need people feeling a sense of urgency about that. We need media stories, data collection, and the like. Even the whole issue of gun violence might be a way of framing how racism is sapping the strength of the whole society through the disproportionate loss, especially of black young men from our nation. So I'm going to ask your advice in terms of timing. This is a 2-minute story that could wrap that up. I had intended that, okay. So I will just share this. This is one of the many allegories that I have developed based on a real life experience. So the experience at the basis of this story about race and racism is when I was studying. I was a medical student, and I was studying with some friends in our apartment, and we were studying long and hard, and it got late, and we were hungry, and there was no food in my apartment. So we decide to go into town and find something to eat. So we walk into town, we find a restaurant, we walk in, we sit down, menus are presented, we order our food, food is served, and here we are eating. Not a remarkable story so far. But as I sat there eating with my friends, I looked across the room and I noticed a sign, and now it got interesting to me, because that sign to me was a profound revelation about racism. So now you're wondering, oh, where did you go to medical school? You know, like, what did the sign say? Well, what the sign said was open. So I know I've lost you again. But here, let me recap. Here we are sitting in this restaurant, eating, I look across the room and I see a sign that says open, and if I hadn't thought anything more about it, I would have assumed that other hungry people could come in, sit down, order their food, and eat. But I knew something about the two-sided nature of those signs, so that I recognized that because of the hour, the restaurant was indeed closed, and that hungry people just a few feet away from me, but on the other side of the sign, would not be able to come and sit down and eat. And then I understood how racism structures open-closed signs in our society, that racism creates a dual reality. And for those who are inside the restaurant, sitting at the table of opportunity, eating, and they look up and they see a sign that says open, they don't even know that there's a two-sided sign going on, because it is difficult for any of us to recognize a system of inequity that privileges us. It is difficult for men to recognize male privilege and sexism. It is difficult for white Americans to recognize white privilege and racism. It is difficult for all Americans to recognize our American privilege in the global context, except we got a little taste of that, if you will, in terms of Ebola. Yet those on the outside are very well aware that there's a two-sided sign going on because it proclaims closed to them, but they can look through the window and see people inside eating. So back inside the restaurant, for those who are asking, is there really a two-sided sign? Does racism really exist? I say, I know that it's hard to know that when you only see open. In fact, it's part of your privilege not to have to know. But once you do know, you can choose to act. So it doesn't compel you to act, it equips you to act, right? It's not a scary thing, it's an empowering thing. And if you care anything about the people on the other side of the sign, right? That's an if, but if you do, then you might even talk to the restaurant owner, who is, after all, inside with you, and you might say, why don't you open the restaurant again? There are hungry people outside. Let them come in. You will make more money and all the conversations we can have. Or you might pass food through the door or break the glass or tear down the sign, but at least what you won't be doing is saying, oh, why don't those people just come on in and sit down and eat? Because you'll understand something about the two-sided nature of the sign. So I will close here, and I have probably gone through my question and answer time, so I'd like to, I guess, have Dr. Kundev introduce, 5 minutes? So if there are 5 minutes of Q&A, I'm happy to take questions. And then knowing that I'm coming back, I have another allegory that is actually perhaps even more explanatory if you want to talk to people about racism, and we'll do some more things. So any questions right now at this point? Or observations? I'd like at least one, yes.
Kevin Sharon, health officer of Orlando. So really great to have both of our speakers here, and especially enjoyed your talk, Dr. Jones, and I've heard it before, of course, at NACHO in Phoenix, as well as other venues. And I wanted to highlight what you brought out about, you know, the disparity in the community with respect to children growing up and then ending up in the prison pipeline. And could you comment about the pre-K to prison pipeline and what we might do both in pediatrics and in family medicine as physicians that might begin to address this in a different way and really begin to impact these children at an earlier stage?
Yes, and what you're referring to is the fact, the observation that even from preschool, black boys are suspended or expelled from preschool at much higher rates than other children. And this has to do with teacher interpretations of behaviors or different, you know, sensitivities to behaviors in some children versus others. So I don't know that the role, I guess the role of physicians would be as citizens. And I even want to say, you know, even physicians, here we are trying to be the best ambulance driver we can be, but even if that's our day job, we need to take a look and see, is there a net above us that's going to help us? Is there a fence? How can we move people away from the edge of the cliff? And how can we call out the three-dimensionality of the cliff? So I would say that, of course, you could counsel parents to be involved in the school and to resist, you know, don't just say, oh, okay, the teacher said this must have happened, so it must have happened, or, you know, but to be actively involved, even at the preschool level, in terms of monitoring what's going on in the classroom with their children, to be present in the schools, to communicate at all times with the administration and all, and not to let those things happen. But honestly, it's not, the parents are not the bulwark there. What's happening is in the media, and the images of young and older black men. I mean, the fact that a three-year-old son of one of my classmates who is from Nigeria, this is when I was in graduate school, asked her mother, "Mommy, when I grow up, are they gonna take me away in handcuffs?" Right? And she says, what should I do? I said, you need to finish your dissertation and go home. But many of us, this is our home, right? This is our home. So what we have to do is we have to deal with media depictions. We need to have we need to shine the bright light of inquiry, not only within our practices and are we treating patients and families differentially, but is there something differential happening in our child's preschool in terms of where the kids are sitting, how often they're encouraged to answer questions when they're raised? You know, what are the communications and the cues that are going on in the classroom? You know, when Black boys hit about third grade, they stop being cute and start looking like threats, apparently, to some people. You know, there's a thing that happens. We need to be on that, and it's not just for physicians, it's for the whole society to say, this is a waste of our human resources. There are many geniuses that are being shunted off. We also, I would say, reading to your children. So we're going to get into the how do you best prepare your children at home? Even when you're pregnant, read to that child while they're in your belly, right? And then continue reading to your children even after they can read, right? Because you can read more advanced stuff than they would easily read home, and it just shows that you have a value for reading. Expose your children to as many things as you can in terms of museums. This is a cultural thing. It's a financial thing. There's a whole thing along with this, but we should make it easy. Our society should be cultured so that there is not a gap between the haves and the have-nots in terms of going to plays, going to museums and the like. And then we as a nation need to try to raise our children to be full citizens. So we need to make sure they can speak more than one language. Make sure they want to read. Make sure they have opportunities to travel, not just across town, but across the country and perhaps around the world, to understand their global citizenship. So there's a whole lot of stuff that we can do, but it's not just on the parents and it's not just on physicians. This is an all hands on deck endeavor if we want to preserve the genius that right now is being wasted left and right in our society. Any other questions or comments?